Glass. I serve as Director of Studies at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Barry, Massachusetts, on the traditional homelands of the Nipmuc Nation. And before any introductions, I want to give you a sense of how the evening's going to unfold. First, though, let me just say that if you would like to have closed captions, that is, if you'd like to see the text of the words that are being spoken, if you go down to the bottom of the Zoom screen, you'll see a button. You can press the button which says live transcript and CC for closed caption. And if you press that button, you'll see the words that are being spoken. So the first part of the evening will be a conversation between Chengxin Han and Paula Arai. And the second part of our time, Chengxin and Paula will be happy to take questions from everyone. And if you have a question at any time, please feel free to send it to me in a chat, note a chat, and I will ask the question. I will pose the question later. If at any point you're having technical difficulties, please feel free to send an email to contact@buddhistinquiry.org. And thank you to my colleague, Kira, who is making all the logistics work smoothly and will respond to that email. So maybe while the chat is still open where everybody can see each other's chats, maybe we could just take a moment to put into the chat where you're calling in from and wave to everybody so we can connect a little bit from all our different places. It's a lot of different places. So sweet to see. Okay, let's all wave to each other too, just to connect a little. Okay. So sweet to see everyone here. And I'm particularly happy to be collaborating this evening with the Institute for Buddhist Studies in Berkeley, which is a unique and I think uniquely important institution in the landscape of studying and practicing the Dharma in North America, and also a place where our speakers are very connected. And for those of you who don't know, I hope you look it up. The Institute for Buddhist Studies offers graduate level education in Buddhist studies with a focus on Pure Land and Shin Buddhist studies, and has a particular emphasis on Buddhist ministry and Buddhist chaplaincy. And representing the Institute for Buddhist Studies is Nancy Lin, who's the Hanyu Professor of Buddhist Chaplaincy, who also does really wonderful, rich work on Tibetan and South Asian studies, and is with us tonight and will introduce our speakers. But first, let me just say a brief introduction to Professor Lin. Nancy has taught at Vanderbilt and Dartmouth and the University of California at Santa Cruz. And personally, I am really inspired by the work that Nancy does, which explores how individuals draw from the resources of their historical and living traditions, including narratives and rituals and values and objects and environments and cosmologies, to make a meaningful practice for themselves. And so Nancy, thank you for the work that you do. And now I'm handing it over to you to introduce our speakers. Thank you.
William, thank you so much for that kind introduction. And thank you to the Barry Center for graciously collaborating with the Institute of Buddhist Studies to host this event. I'm very pleased to see all of you here and to be with you tonight. And it's my distinct honor to introduce Chengxin Han for our event. Some of you may already know her from other events at the Barry Center. And also as the author of a landmark book before the subject of tonight's conversation. So many of you may already know about Be the Refuge, Raising the Voices of Asian American Buddhists. I think in that and her other work where she's written for many Buddhist sources like Lion's Roar, we've seen Chenxing wear many different kinds of hats as researcher, writer, speaker, advocate, and teacher. And this includes serving as a co-organizer of May We Gather, a National Buddhist Memorial for Asian American Ancestors, and as a co-teacher of Listening to the Buddhists in Our Backyard at Phillips Academy Andover. Chenxing has really been a vital voice for young Buddhists and Asian American Buddhists in so many different ways. I'm so pleased to see this memoir that has come out. I first met Chenxing as a colleague at IBS, which is her alma mater, and she also served as our chaplaincy program coordinator. And so I'm forever grateful to Chenxing for her continuing friendship and also how she helped me transition into the field of Buddhist chaplaincy with her characteristic energy and being well-informed and also able to think systemically and at the same time, rare quality to do that and also share the lived texture of chaplaincy, the work of chaplaincy and the training. So I could not be more delighted to be here tonight to hear about and discuss with all of you her book, her new book, One Long Listening, A Memoir of Grief, Friendship, and Spiritual Care. Recently, I went on a family trip to Taiwan, so I have to say that the themes in that book of family, separation, and home, and the uncertainty and tenuousness of the idea of home, those all resonated with me. And also just the how Chenxing's writing really taps into our senses and our sensory world. I was thinking about food a lot because, of course, in Taiwan, your relatives and friends are always telling you about all the food you have to eat there, which includes delicious fruit that is in season. And so I was at a night market in Jiayi one night, and there was a woman there who prepared some guava for us, and just watching her deftly chop the guava into pieces and then dress it with passion fruit, pulp and seeds, and then finish it off with a sprinkling of licorice powder. I was tasting that guava, and it just made me think of Chenxing's book as being this beautiful offering of care to us, as this woman offered delicious fruit to us, where you can really taste the emotions and the experiences of chaplaincy, of life, of grief, and of laughter and joy and all the other things, all the things that come in life and in chaplaincy. So thank you, Chenxing, for sharing this with us. I can't wait to hear you and Paula talk about it. And we are so fortunate to have Professor Paula Arai as Chenxing's conversation partner this evening. Paula is, in the short time that she's been a professor at IBS since this January, I've known her to be tender and courageous and attuned. I feel like those are qualities that she shares in common with Chenxing. So I feel like they're a perfect match for this conversation. Paula, to give a more formal introduction, she is the Eshini and Kakushini Professor of Women in Buddhist Studies at the Institute of Buddhist Studies. Her work is grounded in ethnographic research, which is something that I really love about it. And also I feel resonates with the kind of work that Chenxing has done, talking to living Buddhists and their experiences, and the way in which Paula integrates and uses immersive poetic storytelling in her writing. I feel like you and Chenxing, your writing just resonates on so many levels in how you approach that and approach your work. So for Paula, these include works that I am very impressed and fond of, Women Living Zen and Bringing Zen Home, which look at the lives and work and the wisdom of Japanese Buddhist nuns and Japanese Buddhist laywomen, and also more recently, Painting Enlightenment, in which, you know, her poetic sensitivity really comes through in that as well, in this work on the Buddhist art of Iwasaki Tsuneo. So in both of their abilities to bring forth voices in intimate moments. I am so in admiration of Paula's work and Chen Xing's as well. And I think I will now step back and turn it over to the two of you to discuss Chen Xing's book, One Long Listening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for such a generous introduction. I'm just really moved. Thank you so much to William and Kira and the Berry Center staff for having us to the Institute of Buddhist Studies. Thank you everyone who's joining us here, giving up an hour of this beautiful spring to be with us. We're really looking forward to hearing your insights and your questions together. And thank you so much, Paula. It's just such an honor to be in conversation with you. I remember reading Bringing Zen Home a decade ago at the Institute of Buddhist Studies, more than a decade ago now, and just being so blown away by, wow, this is what scholarship can look like, and it can be so deeply connected. And your fieldwork was for, I think, 14 years, maybe longer, and it sort of continues into the decades, but just the way that you embody such care and connection in your work has influenced and continues to be an influence and inspiration for me.
Thank you. Thank you, Chen Xing. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this launch of your second book. And let's begin. We offer this today to all beings who are grieving, especially those who have the raw losses due to gun violence. We hold you with us. Grieving is in some ways something that comes naturally, but in some ways, in the hecticness of life, it can be hard to know how to grieve. So I would love to hear a story from you, Chen Xing, about how you learned how to grieve.
I love this question so much, and I realize how seldom we ask it to each other and of ourselves. I was turning over this question, and actually what came to mind is this book that I have that my grandmother gave me, my nainai, my dad's mom, and she's woven throughout the memoir as well, but it was one of the few things that we took from Shanghai when I immigrated at the age of 4. And just this shuiyou on the top, which I guess translates to learning buddy, buddy and learning. And at the time I was still writing in Chinese and I wrote a few journal entries. And I write about this in my memoir actually. At a certain point when I realized English was replacing my mother tongue, I ripped those pages out because they just felt like I couldn't fully express myself in them. In some ways, I'm still grieving those lost pages. And that question, how did I learn to grieve? I think it's just a question that goes forever. Like, unlike maybe some of the stories we read, I don't know if there's a beginning or middle or end. I sometimes feel like we're born into grief and that we die with it, but that there's all these other emotions and textures in our life as well. But I think about this notebook and I think about how writing for me was so much a part of learning to grieve, writing multilingually, thinking multilingually. There's a few entries, I think 2002, 2003, 2019, Unlike my other journals, which I sort of compulsively kept starting as a teenager until maybe my 20s, I don't think I'll ever finish this notebook. And there's something apropos to that too, about learning how to grieve, that in a culture that sometimes seems so much to want solutions and the answers and to resolve something and to check it off the list and say, I've conquered this. In some ways, I think grief is unconquerable. I will miss my nanai forever, and I'll also love her forever. And this little object reminds me of that, reminds me that it's not complete, and we're always learning, and we learn from each other, and we learn just from what our lives give us.
Yeah, that's one thing I've, the women who I've worked with in my ethnography, that they taught me is that grief has different seasons, but it doesn't end. And so the concept of getting closure on the loss of someone or something always seemed forced and artificial to me, because the connections can to people can become actually more, in their subtlety, become more intimate and go deeper.
Yeah, that really resonates. I wanted to read a few passages from my book, and then I'm very excited to hear you read from your book too, just so we can bring in some more voices, I think, into this conversation. I thought I'd read briefly from The Bridge, which is kind of like an introduction to the book, just the very end, to orient us a little bit to this book. I wanted to convey in this mala of a memoir, not only what chaplains do, but how chaplaincy feels. Choosing honesty over ease, I let the frustrations and opacities remain. I hope you'll indulge me this choice in the Buddhist spirit of 不知最亲切, not knowing is most intimate. The beads ahead do not conform to linear time. They circle primarily around three autumns of my life. In the fall of 2014, I began a year-long chaplaincy residency program in California. In the fall of 2015, I moved to Taiwan to spend a semester at a Buddhist college. In the fall of 2016, I was undone by a dear friend's too soon death. I've heard it said that there are as many ways to do chaplaincy as there are chaplains. This book is about one chaplain's way. So one of the beads here in part one, which is titled Ichigo Ichie, Ichi Ihue, is on this topic of translation that you and I have talked about previously. My aunt helps me find the words to introduce myself to Chinese-speaking patients at the hospital. This is the aunt who lives in Shanghai, who once thoroughly trounced me at a game of Scrabble when she visited us in Seattle. Footnote: only teenage hubris can explain my surprise at having lost to a woman who read dictionaries cover to cover during the Cultural Revolution. Did I mention she's a translator and writer? End of footnote. We agree that 宗教师, religious teacher, sounds too literal, while 精神支持, spiritual supporter, sounds a bit stiff. She muses, in Chinese, 精神疏导 or 心理疏导 is quite an occupational term, but 关怀 may sound more humane. Alternatively, you can use 人文关怀 or 心灵关怀, which are both suitable in this case, but maybe too extensive in meaning. 神职人员 is awkward for non-believers, but still embraces a broader sense than 牧师, which is strictly used in the Christian context. 牧师, shepherd teacher, is the translation I encounter most often. But the Lord is not my shepherd, and a hospital chaplain's flock is not exclusively Christian, especially not here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I end up explaining not who I am, but what I do, 精神与心理关怀, or simply 关怀, the chaplain's job distilled to a single word, care. From part two of the book, A Short Beat, part two is called Shadow Snake, is how I've translated it. It's called Begonsoi. And this is really a celebration of Reverend Seigen Yamaoka, who was the former bishop of the Buddhist Churches of America and a longtime teacher at the Institute of Buddhist Studies, to whom so many of us are indebted. The Buddhist chaplaincy students at my grad school are required to take one class from a Jodo Shinshu minister who is age-dappled, but still dapper. There is only one assignment for the entire semester. Write an essay about your spiritual journey and read it out loud to your classmates. We ask for more direction. How long? What format? Where to begin? He chuckles and offers only one suggestion. The more suffering, the better. The same Reverend also says, chaplaincy is one of those things where it's hard when you're in it, but then you look back and find the lessons and gifts. He pauses. But really, all of life is like this. And then in the interest of time, I think I'll just read one more section from a little bit later in the book. This is from the section, part four, Wu Yuan Qian Li, or distance no matter. The hospital ID badge pinned above my heart reads, Chen Zing Han, chaplain. The binder cradled in my arms elaborates, Chen Zing Han, spiritual care, Han Zheng Xin, Jing Zheng Yu Xin Li Guan Pai. Other job titles come about more spontaneously. On the oncology unit, a woman is dying, though much slower than the doctors predicted. In her coma of rasping breaths, hours become days, become agonizing weeks. I meet the patient's beloved for the first time outside the room. Eyes ablaze, F assures me that her wife would emphatically not want a visit from a chaplain. Could I refrain from going into the room? I promise I won't go in. As our supervisors remind us, sometimes the greatest act of spiritual care is to give patients and their families the power to turn you away. Some do just that, screaming, get the hell out, which tends to go over less well with the doctor, nurse, social worker, occupational therapist, phlebotomist. We're happy to give people this modicum of choice when so much else is outside their control. Following F's forceful request and my promise to honor it, we lapse into silence. Unsure how to proceed, I follow an instinct. Would you like a hug? Surprise in her gray-green eyes. A slow-motion nod. I encircle F gently at first, but upon registering the fierceness of her reciprocating embrace, I squeeze her tight, feeling the rise and fall of her breath, the heave and heart of her sorrow, until she finally lets go, wipes her eyes, and sighs, I needed that. After that, she calls me the hugging lady. And that is what we exchange each time we cross paths, not words, but hugs, until her wife dies.
Your gift to distill those precious moments in life is rare, it's beautiful, and it opens our hearts and lets us into the complexity and beauty of life. And what you've read is just a small portion of what this book is filled with. And I sometimes think, how can she do this when she's so young? And my answer to that question to myself is that because you go so deep and you're showing us, you're modeling, how do you mine life for its gems? Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. So I love this question so much of tell me a story of how you learn to grieve. I think some of my learning of mining for gems is from you and other mentors and teachers. I wonder if you could speak to that question for your life.
Yeah. Now that you've cracked me open, I hope I can get through it. But this is from a book coming out this summer called The Little Book of Zen Healing. That cold gray afternoon in Nashville, after months of listening to the whir of the oxygen machine that provided continual relief to my mother, a vacuum of silence filled her bedroom. Even though I had known she would die soon, when I stood at the threshold of life and death, I felt like one wrong move would send us off into an abyss of despair. Indeed, the last several months had been one long fear of wrong moves. Too much morphine or not enough. Too much talking or not enough. Not enough water or too much. Suddenly, all the palliatives that had been the source of comfort seemed harshly out of place. Hands shaking in disbelief, I cleared the bedside table of the vials of aquamarine, liquid morphine, anti-nausea salve that was applied behind the ear, and pink star-shaped sponges for removing sticky mucus from the tongue. Then the ultimacy of the moment crashed upon me. How do I assure the passage through this perilous transition? Kito Sensei had said to call her. The elderly Zen nun had helped my mother and me over the last 9 years, freely applying her healing balm of compassion. I knew in my head that Zen rituals recognized the deceased as Buddha, but it was Kito Sensei, in her unheated worship hall 10,000 miles away, who guided me through those terrifying, disorienting moments. Trusting her to know what to do, I followed her instruction on performing the ritual of safely sending off a person on their journey. Rushing about frantic to treat our new Buddha properly, I found the bronze plum blossom incense burner, sandalwood incense sticks reserved for reverencing Buddhas, white candle and plain carved wood figure of Kannon, the goddess of compassion, adding some white chrysanthemum flowers I had kept on hand, sensing they would soon be needed. The bedside table was transformed into a mortuary altar. It had not been more than 10 minutes since my mother breathed her last. As I offered a stick of incense in honor of her, I saw that her face had relaxed into the peaceful smile that I had seen so often on images of Buddhas. Our relationship was transforming before my eyes. Are you my mother? When I placed the incense into the burner, I became one with all who had done so before. In the moment that had threatened to be the loneliest in my life, I experienced instead a profound connection with all grievers from the distant past and deep future. I was not alone. I was held by everyone who had lost a loved one. Kito Sensei had guided us safely through this critical transition with a wisdom that transcended barriers of space, time, life, and death. At that moment, my understanding of ritual's power to heal became a visceral reality. Upon death, all limitations in life are shed as one is released back into the universe of energy. Therefore, deceased loved ones are recognized by the living as Buddhas, who know and understand everything about them and their situation. They offer wisdom, delivered with compassion and a bottomless well of patience and unconditional listening. I call them personal Buddhas. Unlike a major Buddha such as Shakyamuni or Amida, a personal Buddha offers an intimacy that often makes it easier to complain, express frustration, or crack open and cry. And unlike doing that in front of a living loved one, there is no need to calibrate the appropriateness of what to expose and express, nor does an unhelpful tangle of responses ensue. A personal Buddha hears everything, even that which is unexpressed, with compassion. A personal Buddha understands the greater context of a situation and all its intricate convolutions. It can be profoundly healing to be heard and understood in this way. Many a personal Buddha has been beseeched for guidance, and the interaction often yields a calmer, more clear-eyed ability to flow in sync with unfolding dynamics. Leaning on deceased loved ones while sitting at a home altar reflects the wisdom that an extended foundation of support stabilizes the present, imbuing a home with warmth and depth. A home altar can inspire a bounty of healing activities, from fostering intimate connections with self and deceased loved ones, to engaging in creative rituals that transform your experience of suffering. Not operating in chronological time, healing activities work through all the senses to cultivate wisdom in the bones. Grief is a catalyst for healing. Healing grief carves the landscape of your heart in ways that open up deeper pathways of connection to others.
It's so lovely. There in the corner is a beautiful altar, and just your home that you've so graciously invited us both to is such an embodiment of these teachings as well. I feel like your mom, this personal Buddha, is here with us in the form of this bell that you had purchased in her honor in Japan.
So often, a chaplain is the bridge that helps people face loss, loss of ability, function, and loss of life. So how was it to be that bridge for people?
It was humbling, it was hard, it was such a precious education. You know, I think the original subtitle for my book was My Education in Buddhist Chaplaincy. I'm not a badge-wearing chaplain, not a label-bearing one, I sometimes say. I went into the training suspecting that it probably would not be something I could do full-time, and yet also suspecting that it would transform anything that came after, or maybe even show me what needed to come after. And I'm reminded the story you read of a patient who was Taiwanese American in the hospital, whom I became quite close to her, and her daughter was working a lot. And so she really wanted me to spend time with her mom, particularly since I was the only Mandarin speaking chaplain on the spiritual care team. And I was there on call the day that she died. And I was remembering her final moments, this being this bridge, being this translator, sort of both linguistically, but also just beyond language in a way, right? Between silence and sound, this bearing witness, I think, that is something that we don't always get to be present for. And it's hard. And it's also such a gift, to kind of like Reverend Yamaoka was saying. I just remember her son had just flown in from Asia, and it was really her last hours. And so just talking to her, explaining to her what the nurse was doing, and just expressing to my thanks for her. And I think in a way, you know, it's, for me, chaplaincy was about learning a different way of inhabiting the self, maybe. It wasn't like I'm here to help and then this person's going to be helped and then we'll go home and be like, check that box, that was great, I feel so good about myself. I think the scariest thing about the practice of spiritual care was going in not knowing how that interaction would transform me, or how it would maybe even force me to start to look at my own griefs. And sometimes those are griefs that seem little but feel really big. And I think it was really through reflecting on these encounters, which I'm a slow writer, so this book took maybe 9 years from the first scribblings until its publication. That reflection, I think, helped me see the ways that I hadn't fully grieved loss of family, loss of culture, loss of language as a Chinese American, as a 1.75 generation immigrant. And so in a way, I felt like I was just there in it with everyone else, while also recognizing having always a degree of power and privilege, because unlike the people in the hospital, I could go home at the end of the day. And so holding that all in a kind of dance, I feel like still I'm learning that dance in this kind of stumbling way, and maybe we all are. Yeah.
Well, thank you for modeling how to dance, how the grief is a way of being, of accepting what's happening, facing the fear, and also paying attention to those precious moments, like imagining you knowing that you're with this other person's mother at the end, and those very precious moments, those last things that she heard, that may we all experience things like that so we can feel, see, experience how porous we are, how connected we are. And like I had that insight that I wasn't alone in facing my mother's death, that countless people before had done that, that buoyed me along. It didn't take away the pain, but it put it in this much bigger context where I felt embraced and held, and with all the terrible things that we are exposed to through the media at a much higher rate than people historically had to face, that in a way we are called to be, I want to say, you know, expert grievers, or we have to become, we are called to train, to cultivate, because there's so many people, as you say, we get to go home, but there's so many people who maybe they go home to someone who's not there anymore. And I think, you know, Nashville, Louisville, and so many more, that not that anybody knows how to do this, but that we can be there, we can be present for it, and that doesn't make it go away and everything beautiful and wonderful again. But I think that kind of connection that we can feel through loss is some of the most profound connections humans can have with each other, and it humanizes us.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's about getting comfortable with the discomfort of grief. I don't know if I ever become an expert, but right, just knowing that it's okay to not know, and it's okay to stumble in this dance, but to still be willing to feel those emotions. And I think at some point I've gotten to a point where then it's more uncomfortable to try to push down the grief and try to reject it or deny it. Something that I was wondering for the passage you read that I could really resonate with sometimes this feeling of not enough, I think, came up for me a lot as learning to be a spiritual caregiver, and maybe comes up for all of us in various aspects of our lives. And I think it's not just the, I think it's especially painful when one has already encountered some kind of loss, and then one continues to feel, oh, I'm not even enough in how I'm grieving. I'm not grieving the right way or doing my rituals the right way. And I was also thinking about how your work so engages the senses. And I just wondered if there's a bridge or connection there. There's a way in which my discursive mind could say, you're not doing this right, and this, that, and the other, but then holding a stick of incense and smelling it, or eating the food that was so lovingly prepared, like the example Nancy gave, there's something about returning to that where maybe it can help us go beyond these dualities of right or wrong and taps into a place of sincerity. But I suppose I was curious to hear you speak about it, and really to hear you speak on how you learn to engage the senses and engage ritual as a modality for healing grief.
So now I want to take back that word expert. We just have to become more comfortable, as you say, doing these things and be creative about how to grieve. That may sound like an oxymoron, but the more creative we are with learning to grieve, the more we can integrate the losses into our whole being. And then the more we can offer to others a place where it's safe to be raw. And so I've found, you know, the smells, the sounds, the colors, that those are gentle ways to open us up. They kind of pull us out of despair, and they are, in a sense, the bridges that we can cross to each other.
The time is going so quickly. I think we suspected this would happen. Oh, I'm wondering, there is that last passage from my book, this last bead, and I feel called to read it, if that's okay with you and the audience. This book is dedicated to a really dear friend of mine, Amy Frohnmeyer-Winn, who died at the age of 29 of cancer. And she had a rare genetic illness called Fanconi anemia that she and two of her older sisters both passed away from. And throughout the book, there are letters to her, letters that I was fully able to send to her, although I think she's listening, and I think she's read them in her own way. I think just friendship is also this way of helping us with just the enormities of life, all the ups and downs, all the waves and wilds of samsara that we encounter. And so I think I wanted, maybe before we turn it over to audience question and answer, just to read, if I can find my page, this letter, which is from the, I think it's part four of the book, Journey Windward, or Yilu Shen Feng, which is a blessing that my nai nai, my grandmother, would always say to me before I went on any trip. So, my dear, you'll visit many a hospital in your life, but not the one where I did my year-long CPE training. Like the hospital where you will spend your final days, this one employs a massage therapist. I can leave Anne a message anytime. Ask her to visit so-and-so in room 7711 when she's at the tower next. Ours is a natural alliance, since she prioritizes working with cancer patients, and I've remained on oncology through the fall and spring semesters. We'll be staying on through the shorter summer semester too. Anne says I have a calm beyond my years. I want to demur, but I thank her because I am learning to accept compliments. Another woman I love to run into is the phlebotomist. "Girl," she exclaims the first time we meet, "how'd you get those biceps?" "Look who's talking," I rib. "CrossFit," she grins proudly. Once upon a time, I swam and did yoga several days a week, but in this sleep-deprived year, I'm lucky to squeeze in a weekly jog. So, in answer to her question, what my mama gave me, the phlebotomist lets out a low whistle when she glimpses my badge. "I could never do your job," she declares. "There's no way I could do hers either." The very suggestion of a needle makes me woozy. The sight of blood threatens to have me on a gurney in 2 seconds flat. I probably should have thought of these things before I signed up to work in a hospital. "Focus on your gifts, not your lack," my supervisor urges. And I believe one of my supervisors is here with us, Venetia Rayford. Thank you so much to you, to Carrie, to Lavera for making this book possible, for telling me that chaplaincy needs writers too. When we pass each other in the hospital halls, the phlebotomist and I curl our biceps and give each other a snappy high five. "I think you'd approve, dear friend. I believe you called this the purpose of these human lives, loving on each other like nobody's business." So, Paul, I just wanted to thank you for loving on this baby book like nobody's business. And just, wow, it's such a joy to spend this time with you.
Oh, likewise. Yeah. Likewise. It gives me hope. Mm. You give me hope.
Thank you so much, Cenk Singh and Paula. I really love listening to you speak. And there's some wonderful questions that have come in. And the one we'll start with is there anything, Cenk Singh, that you learned in the writing of this book that surprised you, especially compared to your previous book? Is there anything that stands out as different in the writing journey itself?
Yeah, my previous book, the interviews with 89 different people, weaving together all those different voices, did feel like quite a different process. I don't think I realized I was writing this book for a long time. It began when a friend just said, "Oh, I don't really know what chaplaincy is. Could you maybe write about that?" And as people who've done clinical pastoral education know, you have to do a lot of writing during the educational process anyway. So I had these stories. And then when Amy died, I think that was the opening. I think I was just beginning to write to her. And she had this gift of making incredible collages. She would sometimes spend years on a collage, just finding the right pieces and elements. And in a way, this became this word collage where I realized it was this love letter to her, but also to the patients and their families and the staff at the hospital, my supervisors. And I think maybe what surprised me the most, though it probably shouldn't have, was that it also became this kind of love letter to my ancestors and lineage and my family and my parents. And I got to read the audiobook for this book, which was so, I often read out loud when I read my writing and revise accordingly, but I've never had to record so closely. And the big surprise was that my mom and dad made cameos, and there was something very healing about that. I haven't always had the easiest relationship with them, but maybe the most surprising thing was that this process of writing this book, I think, reconnected me to them in ways that surprised me.
What a beautiful way of thinking about your parents there with you with the book. So maybe Paula, maybe you could start with this question. You began this evening with a ritual, a grieving ritual of sort for recent victims of mass shootings. And you spoke several times this evening, and your own work addresses this, the importance of ritual. And Cenk Singh, even the way you described giving a hug in the hospital, that also is a kind of ritual, a very embodied ritual. And I'm wondering, Paul, if you can say anything about, this is based on a couple of different questions, if you would want to say something about the role of ritual here, and you also ended with being creative grievers, like where does creativity come in, where does ritual come in? If you could say a little bit about that.
So the way I think about ritual is that it's meaning-making activity. And all of us make meaning of everything we see and do. We might not be carefully constructing the meaning, but ritual is when you, this situation warrants you going deep and connecting to something more than just what's on the surface. And so to ritualize an activity is really to, in my mind, to do it with intention and to pay attention to what then makes sense to do, what meaning to make. You have to face fears. You have to face discomfort and pain. Face things that you don't want to face. And in that process, you make friends with all those very difficult emotions. And so ritualizing an activity, saying, I am like lighting this stick of incense as an offering both to people I've lost and knowing that the smoke goes everywhere, that you are not alone, you're connecting with all these grievers, that you can literally see the smoke moving beyond. And so to notice what action, what activity, what sense comes easily to you in that moment, whether it's sound, smell, colors, particular motion, bowing, standing, that's what I mean by being creative, is in finding what works for you in that moment to express the deepest part of you that is grieving. Nobody else knows that as well as you. And so to give yourself permission to maybe have a repertoire of things that other traditions have already established, but then put them together in the ways that make you feel safe and comforted. And so where creativity and grief and ritual meet is healing.
I love the playful spirit that also is there, both in your work and then in this invitation, I think, to be creative. I just wanted to lift up that piece too. And there's a way in which that invitation, I think, begins from like this abundant sense of just enoughness, like whatever we have, even if it's just a few grains of sand with which I'm going to make a little stupa, whatever we have is just enough. And that, again, this idea that we don't grieve alone, but that there's almost a kind of play, you know. I think hearkening back to that last question, something that surprised me, I think, was the joy that came out of writing this book, Grief is on the Cover. And yes, I remember rehearsing the audiobook and then just suddenly finding myself crying and being totally surprised and startled, but then also just laughing out loud. And I think there's something about going deeply into grief that helps us inhabit even more deeply like all the other wide spectrum of emotions that we are steeping in, immersing in these human lives of ours.
One of the easy things to find joy making an offering, say, I'm thinking of what Nancy was explaining about the fruit, that it's very common to make an offering to a deceased loved one of their favorite food that maybe is in a certain season. And so that joy of being able to offer it, and then after it's been offered, to enjoy it among the people gathered, that it is this literally nourishing connection that just bubbles up. And yes, so the ritual does not have to all be somber. There are all kinds of seasons, including joy.
Thank you both. There are a handful of questions which I think I'm going to merge into one because they seem deeply related to me. One is, how does your Buddhist practice support you as a chaplain? And a related one is, how do we keep in touch with our grief and emotions and recognize burnout and compassion fatigue? They seem related to me. And then a third one, which was also related, was, how do you hold space and listen to other people's grief and support them without being overwhelmed yourself? So those, to me, the three seem tied together. Maybe you could take it from there and take it whatever direction you'd like.
Yeah, I remember our supervisor saying, be unwavering in your self-care. You know, I think there's other people in this room who are currently professional chaplains or have been for a long time, who could maybe answer this question better than I can. As to the first one about Buddhist practice, I think it's, for me, hard to see it as separate from my life. It's just steeped through and through. And so I can't quite imagine my life without it, but I think every day it offers something new and surprising as a refuge, as a support, whether that's in the form of chant, or so often it's just in the form of spending time with amazing spiritual friends and teachers, or reading a Buddhist book, or it's, to me, this boundless font of creativity. And so that really energizes me for the work. And I think the self, that burnout piece and the overwhelm piece, is so hard. In a way, it's why I knew for myself, for my limitations and generosities both, that at that point in my life, I couldn't continue with full-time chaplaincy, but I hoped to take the lessons of spiritual care more broadly into the world. And I still struggle with this. I think these feelings of overwhelm, to feel deeply is also to sometimes find it hard to release, release some grief that is bigger than me. I'm curious, Paula, to hear more, since you've also experienced, I think, some really major griefs in your life, and how you navigate that. But I'm continually grateful for the healing effects of nature, and I'm also continuously aware that sometimes the systems in our life are really set up to wear us down and burn us out. And I think that sometimes there's only so much we can do as individuals before there are times and seasons where one needs to pause or even stop or reassess, and also consider, are there forces that are bigger than me systemically that are making this just an impossible road to travel on?
Yeah, well, nature too for me is critical for self-care and for not being in despair, because any little look around the world, there's so much suffering, so many negative things happening. And so sometimes I've struggled with all that suffering out there. I feel bad that I feel okay. and to just allow myself, no, it's okay. In fact, it's necessary to enjoy doing something guilt-free, just laugh, play games. And that's something, you know, I did not always do well, and I've gotten better at seeing that I'm not being less focused and serious and effective at doing what I'm committed to, but it's actually helping me do it better, because maybe modeling it better, because I'm living too. I'm not just always, you know, studying and crying, which there have been phases where those dominated the day. But so to laugh is a sign that you're grieving, if that makes sense. That grief, not grieving, would be to be cut off. And grieving opens you up, and laughter is definitely, literally, your mouth opens and you are connecting with the people around you, the environment. So that's something I've learned along the way, is that's sometimes what grief looks like, enjoying life.
Maybe this will be the final question. It's actually from Nancy. And Nancy points out that in your book, Shengsheng, you quote one of my very favorite passages in the Pali Canon about spiritual friendship or admirable friendship being not the whole of the Buddhist path or the holy life, but not the half, but the whole of the Buddhist path. And seeing the two of you speaking tonight feels like an embodiment of admirable friendship. And this is a lesson in itself, seeing the two of you engage together. But Nancy is also wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how the theme of admirable friendship figures in your book.
Yeah, I think it's woven throughout, you know, the beauty of CPE. I think I was really fortunate to have such amazing supervisors and this wonderful group of residents. We just quickly became friends, kind of loving on each other. It's not that there wasn't conflict, but that was a space of spiritual friendship with friends of different religious backgrounds. And Amy, I think, was just a very, very dear spiritual sister to me. I love what you were just saying, Paula, about laughter and joy. And I think as Amy was dying, she became funnier and she became just more irreverent, and like channeling that in the book. And she knew from a young age that she would have less time than most of us. So for me, she was always a kind of spiritual friend, bodhisattva, also just an inspiration and a reminder that living deeply and fully requires these friendships. I don't know, there's no other way. Like this, I find it very weird that my name is on the cover of this book. I've said that for Be the Refuge, that remains the same, and maybe the Hugging Lady would be better on the cover here. But this, yeah, even this book being possible is this result of friendships. And in a way, I think all of the patients I met were these encounters. Sometimes the encounters felt like more like we were enemies, or it was not always a joyful interaction. And yet upon reflection, I think too, those encounters, like the woman who said I was a vampire, and she had a fair point. I was not doing so well in that chaplaincy visit. It was really imposing on her. I remember that visit. But even that became in time a kind of spiritual friendship, these lessons that we learn from every encounter. And so, yeah, I love this question. I think it's just a reminder, spiritual friends come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And sometimes it's the wind, and sometimes it's, you know, the dog that comes up to you on the beach and just nuzzles your hand when you're feeling so down, and that's just exactly what you needed. And I guess I see spiritual friends everywhere. And in those times of burnout or despair, somehow remembering that and reconnecting to that always really helps me and helps to lift me.
I imagine that is a mark of awakening, seeing spiritual friends everywhere. That is what we want to cultivate, indeed. We also want to cultivate generosity. That is, at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, none of our teachers are contracted. Nobody who speaks on our behalf is contracted. And we try to cultivate this practice of generosity, of dana, which is a strange practice in a world so dominated by capitalism, when we're all entrepreneurs. The kind of neoliberalism is just so, that's the sea that we bathe in. And so trying to find these other structures of livelihood, of wholesome livelihood, that is grounded in generosity. And of course, for Buddhists, generosity is very important. It's the first perfection, the first virtue, the first task that is cultivated by a bodhisattva, because it opens up everything else. It's both the renunciation of things that we are clinging to and we practice relinquishing, but also directly meeting the needs of others. And in this case, the needs of others include housing, clothes, food, the food, housing, the clothing, the insurance for our teachers, the dog food, if they have a dog who nuzzles them at home. So at BCBS, we share the dana with our teachers, and we invite you to offer dana for Paula and Cheng Sing, which some of which would also go to supporting the staff at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. So you will be receiving a email from BCBS, and there is a link in there. And as with any time we invite dana, we also want you to know that one way we experience generosity, there's the dana link. Thank you, Kira, for putting it in the chat. There's also a link to a survey. We want to know about your experience, and we think of that as an expression of dana also, to share with us something about your experience. And we also think that taking what you've listen to deeply here and going out and being spiritual friends for others is also an expression of dana. It's all part of cultivating generosity. And of course, we would never want anybody to give more than they're comfortable with. Shanti Davis says we should start with vegetables and not give away so much that we would resent what we're giving away. So with that in mind, let me express my deep gratitude, Cheng Sing and Paula, for your generosity in sharing tonight, and also Nancy for your generosity in being here and for collaborating with the Institute of Buddhist Studies. And Cheng Sing and Paula, let me hand it back over to you for a final few minutes.
Thank you so much, William, and thanks to everyone just for your generosity of presence and listening. We thought we would close just with a short dedication of merit from this book, Until Nirvana's Time, Buddhist Songs from Cambodia. We want to thank Trent for his generosity again, being right behind the camera here with helping with the audio and the tech, and of course being the author of this book. So the chant is on page 95, and we'll ask Trent to begin the chant to lead us with this dedication of merit, and with that we'll close the evening.
Find bliss,
Shake off distress
and cross
to reach Nirvana's shore. In every life may I give alms and hold precepts. May all my vows be soon realized. My bones, my bridge to realm supreme. I share the fruit of my merit with my parents, my preceptors, my wise teachers, and all my kin, gone and to come. May my forebears matter where they now reside, share in the joy of my blessings. May they find peace from
Thank you everyone for joining us and wishing you a peaceful evening.
Thank you.
I put everybody other than Lee in the waiting room. Don't put Lee in the waiting room. Lee is a very, very dear friend of myself and Nancy's. Hi, Lee. Driving her kids back from boxing class.
Oh. I think you're muted, Lee.
You're muted, Lee. And don't crash.
You can unmute yourself right now.
Try again, Lee. Oh, there you go.
I just pulled into the driveway. Lovely to see you all. Oh, so beautiful. Thank you. Thanks for letting me say hi, William. So good to see you, Chen Sing and Nancy and William. And Paula, we haven't met yet in person, but I'm delighted to be able to listen to your wisdom again and look forward to meeting someday.
Yes.
And Kira, maybe you'll meet Kira. Kira's part of the Buddhist program at HDS. So if you're there this weekend, maybe you'll.
Yes. Oh, I'd love that. Yeah. Wow. I think we have a lunch scheduled for the HDS students on Saturday, I think.
Yeah, I think.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Looking forward to that too. And also, should we did you stop the recording yet? Should we do that or
let's
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.